Welcome to the BMJ podcast. I'm Cameron Abassi, Editor-in-Chief of the BMJ. This week, we'll hear from the mother of a deaf boy who says that it would be beneficial for medical staff to at least learn some sign language.
Because I think sometimes if you know the medical model of deafness, you think that's maybe enough, but it doesn't actually translate into knowing how to communicate with deaf people.
We'll also have a musical interlude, courtesy of the London Medical Orchestra. But first, the Supreme Court in the US is hearing evidence on a case which could determine access to medical abortion. Mifepristone's safety and therefore overall approval by the FDA is being questioned by those who seek to limit its availability. Central to that case are studies which link abortion to mental health harm, studies which are contested, and some of which have been retracted. Now, writing in the BMJ, Julia Littell and Antonia Biggs and co-authors think that journal editors should do more to remove the studies they think are flawed.
From NBC News, this is Today.
The U.S. Supreme Court is re-entering the abortion debate. It agreed yesterday to review a lower court ruling that would significantly restrict access to mifepristone, a drug used in medication abortions. Demand for the pills has grown.
My name is Antonia Biggs, and I'm a social psychologist. I'm an associate professor at the University of California, San Francisco, in a program called Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health. And my expertise lies in studying the effects of abortion and mental health outcomes, as well as the effects of restrictions and on people's mental health. Currently, we have a case at the Supreme Court, which is going to be heard at the end of March. And they are considering whether mifepristone, which is one of the medications used in medication abortion, whether its approval for use in the, it was approved for use in the United States 24 years ago, in 2000. And they are arguing whether or not it should have been approved in the first place. And front and center in their claim in this lawsuit against the FDA is that abortion is unsafe and that it causes mental health harm. We have several leading medical health and medical organizations and professional associations that have commissioned reviews on the literature. So the American Psychological Association, as well as the National Academies of Sciences and Engineering in the U.S., also the Royal Colleges in the U.K., and they've all come to the conclusion that abortion does not risk mental health harm. I think that the overall consensus in the literature is that abortion does not cause mental health harm. However, the presence of some flawed science has certainly muddied the waters and caused some confusion about the state of the literature.
I'm Julia Littell. I'm a professor emeritus at the Bryn Mawr College Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research. My expertise is in research methodology and research synthesis methodology in particular. It's my understanding that some of the other assertions about harmful effects of abortion, particularly medication abortion, have been more easy to debunk than some of the assertions about mental health effects. The mental health data are more complex and right now more hotly contested.
And front and center in their claim in this lawsuit against the FDA is that abortion is unsafe and that it causes mental health harm. So in that opinion, they stated that that one of the problems with the original approval was that the FDA didn't consider those safety effects. So they didn't consider the psychological harm of medication abortion. And in order to substantiate that claim, they relied on papers that we feel are severely flawed and should be retracted. And three of them have now just recently been retracted because of They said that because of undeclared conflicts of interest, as well as lack of scientific rigor. And then there's one other paper that was also cited that we talk about in our BMJ commentary that has not been retracted, but it is a paper that claims that abortion causes mental health harm.
So, court relies on expert opinion, and the courts aren't scientists, and they're not really trained to critique what's presented to them. So when an expert witness presents a point of view that citing some studies, and the court doesn't have the expertise to push back on that. So you can make a lot of claims based on studies with logical fallacies that aren't going to be necessarily caught in court. So the experts quickly shift to other issues. They don't really delve into the logical fallacies that have been pointed out in this work. And they cite other things like citation metrics, which really don't get at the quality or the integrity of the science. They cite their influence in prior court cases. And they talk about the fact that journals have not retracted some of these studies. And it is true, as Antonia mentioned, that journals have let stand some studies on the effects of abortion on mental health that draw invalid conclusions. That's what our BMJ analysis paper is all about. But because they're in print, they can be used as evidence in court.
Yeah, and I even had a personal experience where I was testifying in a case arguing for a mandated waiting period law. And this review paper was presented as evidence. And in my testimony, I described the flaws that I saw in that paper and whether or not I thought that evidence should be used. And their claim was, well, it hasn't been retracted, so that means it's a valid study. And I think it just shows the power of a publication can have an incredible huge influence, and it's really important that we have high quality literature.
So we have requested retraction for some of the papers that we describe in our article. And instead of retracting, even though we've clearly demonstrated the logical fallacies, the empirical problems, the illogical conclusions, the journal editors have asked for more debate. I mean, journals have an ethical obligation and are responsible for the accuracy of the material they publish. So that is sort of agreed to in the Journals Professional Association, in the Committee on Publication Ethics. And there are consensus statements that when a journal discovers that a statement is invalid or unreliable, it needs to correct or retract that. And this is the whole idea of science correcting itself. Mistakes are made, and we're human. We will make mistakes, but we learn by correcting the mistakes. We can't move science forward. We can't have progress if we don't correct our mistakes. So the calls for retraction, which we have written and many other people have written as well, are very detailed arguments about why papers should be retracted, but they do not see the light of day. Right now those calls for retraction are not public, and so journals can sit on their hands and the court proceeds without knowledge of the argument for retraction of these papers. So science corrects itself, I would say, too slowly, and at the risk of real policy and public health harm, especially to the most disadvantaged.
So we're gonna see what happens in this case, but if they decide and they agree that the FDA should never have approved medication abortion, this could result in a national ban of medication abortion, or it could also roll back some of the restrictions on medication so that it no longer can be mailed or sent by mail. So it could bring it back to requiring an in-person dispensing requirement. So we will see what will happen. But what is incredibly disappointing is how the case does that they were able to rely on these cherry-picked studies instead of relying on the, you know, body of literature, which is how it's really, these really are not scientifically based arguments.
So, big questions for journal editors like us, and I'm joined by Helen McDonald. Helen is the BMJ's content integrity editor, and we're going to ruminate on that particular challenge. Hello, Helen.
Hi, Cameron. Yes, it is a big question for us in particular, as one of the papers they talk about in their article is actually a BMJ one.
Helen, tell me a little bit about retractions. What would qualify as a retraction? We both know, I think many listeners will also know, that any research paper, let's talk about research papers, once it's published, is often challenged. People critique it. They raise questions about the methodology. That's commonplace. What moves those particular paper into the realm of a retraction?
Sure. So there's various reasons why you would retract, and some of this has become standard in some ways across publishing. So the Committee of Publication Ethics, known as COPE, have industry guidance that we can turn to. It doesn't help us in all situations, but it's a useful starting point. So some of the reasons why we might retract is if we find there's clear evidence that the work is unreliable, that there's been a major error, that there's been fabrication or falsification in some kind of way. It might be that there's an issue with plagiarism or duplicate publication. Other issue could be an ethical issue, inadequate ethics approval. So there's a whole variety of reasons that we look at. But the issue that you raise there about the methodology is a really interesting one. And one of the difficult things that we're often trying to weigh up is when a limitation of a research paper becomes so profound that it becomes a fatal flaw. And of course, there's situations where that's quite clear, but there's other situations where it's quite difficult. And when you look at our sort of corpus, we've been publishing for a long, long time. And so what might be considered best practice now in 2024, the way that a method might be done, could be quite different in older science. But it doesn't stop the fact that that older science is being used today to make decisions with. So those are some of the issues that we can face weighing up cases which come down to opinions about the way in which the study design or the analysis of the data were conducted.
Okay, so what you're describing is that there can be, and often there is, a difference of interpretation, different judgments.
It might be about what happened or, as you say, about the interpretation of those findings, whether the authors might have gone too far. Typically, they tend to make grander conclusions. I'm not sure we've had a case where people have said people haven't gone far enough in their conclusions.
No, I've never seen one of those. So how do we resolve those conflicts, Helen, when they happen? If a complainant says, I insist you retract this paper, and we're thinking, well, it doesn't quite meet the criteria for retraction.
I think part of it is communication, so communicating our expectations. So in the case that we were just talking about whether a limitation is so huge that it becomes a flaw, it's explaining that in part, I think, to the authors and to the person who's raising the issue with us, and then considering whether there's any more that we can do. Retraction is one option, but of course it could be that although the paper doesn't meet the criteria for retraction, perhaps it should be corrected, or perhaps the authors want to add a note to the paper, or the editors want to add a note to the paper to explain an important factor, to sort of clarify something. Or we might consider that we want the authors to do something more informal, or we might want to write something more informal in the rapid responses, or even indeed to commission fresh or different content around the issue.
Yeah. So what we've publicly stated is that we are going to be willing to retract more papers. I think because of the greater attention that's now being paid to research, just the way the research ecosystem is working, I think we're going to inevitably uncover more and more papers that are problematic. I'm not talking about this paper in particular that was mentioned in the conversation we've just heard. So we said we will retract more, but that equally doesn't mean that, you know, every time an author, a reader or a listener or somebody or a methodologist looks at a paper and says, I don't agree with those findings, you should retract them. That doesn't mean we're going to automatically retract those papers, because the business of science is debate and the business of a journal is debate. And the publication of one of our papers is only one point in the ongoing debate around that particular research question.
And that's interesting in this case, or the case of the papers that are being discussed in this article that's come up around abortion, that when you're publishing an individual research paper, you're publishing a piece of science which at the point it was published was judged to be sufficiently sound to be published. But it doesn't mean to say that that particular piece of science gives you the answer in the entirety to the question. And we know that if you're going to produce a reliable answer to that question at any point in time, what you need to conduct is a systematic review of all of the evidence and bring all that evidence together and look at it. And a paper that is, you know, out of kilter with the body of the evidence isn't necessarily wrong. They may just be describing their findings, but it's about, on balance, what the answer is. And it was really interesting listening to the authors talking there, and I'd not fully appreciated that kind of court context of the way the evidence is using. It was surprising to me that the expert witnesses are sort of allowed to cherry pick information to quite the extent that they do. And even that the case, which is really about the benefit and harm of a drug, sort of tips into actually more of a broader discussion about the benefit and harm of abortion. So it's sort of interesting to see how that information is used once it leaves the journal, that the uses that the content that you put out to can be put to.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think one of the interesting aspects of this paper is that there's a very strong call on editors to take action, to retract papers, to correct papers. And we accept that. I think that's right. But I mean, one point that I think isn't emphasized in the way that needs to be, actually, is that when you get into that legal process, whether it's a US court or a UK court or wherever the court is, actually, it's the job of the lawyers in that court case and the judge for them to call witnesses who are able to enable them to make a judgment, an appropriate judgment, about the strength of the evidence that's being presented. So while I accept that there is a responsibility on editors to take action when they need to correct something, correct it. That's one of our principles at the BMJ. When you need to retract something and it meets the criteria, you should retract it. That's actually good. That's the right thing to do. But we mustn't say that that's the only way of solving this particular issue. I mean, the responsibility is as much on the legal system to make sure it's making an appropriate assessment, judgment itself on the evidence as it would on any piece of evidence.
I couldn't agree more, Cameron.
Good. Well, I'm glad you do. So in this case then, where are we at? Why haven't we retracted this paper, Helen?
Well, I think it's something we need to look into. And I think it's worth saying that these investigations take time, right? Some serious issues have been raised and we need to go away and think about them. And it's complex, and we need to review the paper. We need to look at what discussions happened online on our rapid responses about it. We need to look at some of the information that the authors have shared about how this information is being used. And then we need to come to a decision about whether we need to take any further action or not ourselves.
Okay, so the position is we've got it under review and we are looking into this, and we will make a decision as soon as we're able to.
Absolutely. I'll come back
and
tell you the decision.
Okay, well, thank you, Helen. And that paper is the analysis paper written by Julia Littell, Antonia Biggs and colleagues. You can find their analysis piece on bmj.com. Still coming up, we'll have some music from the London Medical Orchestra. But next, sign language in the clinic. Waking up from anaesthetic is confusing enough for adults, but imagine you're a three-year-old and on top of that, you only communicate in British Sign Language. Emma Doble, the BMJ's patient editor, has been speaking to the mother of such a child. Emma, welcome. Deafness isn't just a medical condition, it also has great and deep cultural impact, and cultural awareness is important. What did you learn from this particular story?
Yeah, absolutely, Cameron. I think for me, working with Kirsten and hearing about her experience and her son's experience of kind of coming into this world, I really opened my eyes to see how the deaf community is a really strong one and that they have a huge amount of respect and encouragement and empowerment for of each other and other families. And Kirsten spoke a lot about how her and her son have met other families who are experiencing deafness and how amazing and inspirational that has been. So definitely learning about deaf culture has been a new one for me. I didn't know about this, and it's been really interesting hearing about what that means to families.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly an issue that isn't addressed enough in medical journals. I mean, I'll readily admit that it isn't something that we give sufficient prominence to in the BMJ. I wonder how we might do more.
I think certainly giving people who've experienced it a voice, a platform and a space to do that is really important. I think thinking about how we produce our content and making sure that that's accessible for everybody in the best way possible. And I think, you know, often with many health conditions, the actual medical side of it is one element. And that's something that we always talk about, is that much wider impact on that person's life. And so making sure that we have patient co-authors on our education articles or thinking about those wider patient perspectives to include in our articles is also something that I think is really important that we do.
Yeah, this has been a good way to highlight this particular issue. We have a certain article type, which we call What Your Patient is Thinking. We know it as a WIPIT in the BMJ, What Your Patient is Thinking. Is this a typical type of article in that series?
Yeah, so this is the sort of type of article that we're always aiming for in the WIPIT series. So it's something that's really embedded in that lived experience. So anybody, whether you're a patient, a carer, a family member, someone with lived experience can write one of these pieces. And so having the opportunity to share your own kind of personal experience and personal journey, but most importantly with these articles, is that they have some sort of learning. And for me, the ones that work best are those learning points that a healthcare professional could read and go and do tomorrow. So something that's really actionable, that's really clear, and that's something that they feel like they can go away with and actually do something with, which this one, I think, provides a really nice example of that. And also just being able to hear how much impact that could have on somebody, and in this case, in Kirsten's son. You know, just imagining if just one person had a little bit of sign language to understand him signing mummy, that's not a lot to ask, but it would have made such an incredible difference to him and to her.
Mm. Let's hear your chat with Kirsten.
Hi, I'm Kirsten. I am wife of one and mum of two. We live in Scotland, and one of my sons has a profound hearing loss.
And so how does that affect your son, Kirsten? How does he find that navigating life with such a profound hearing loss?
So it affects a lot of things. He's a brilliant problem solver. So actually he can manage a lot of things, but he wears bilateral cochlear implants. He had surgery last year, and they give him access to sound, and he is starting to learn spoken English and connecting sounds with, you know, things. At the moment, so it's tricky. It means that he uses British Sign Language, he not everyone uses sign language, so it can cause communication barriers. It affects how he interacts with other children his age. He's only five, so he's in nursery, and most of the kids use spoken English there. Lots of things. It affects every interaction, really. But he's just, he's a happy, regular wee boy as well.
So, Kirsten, in your article, you've explained your sort of journey with Benji and getting his cochlear implants, and obviously your experience with him being in an audiology department and people not knowing the sign language and not therefore being able to understand when he was asking for you, his mum, which I can't even imagine. That's just heartbreaking to hear. And I just wondered if you could tell us a bit more about that whole experience and how that was for you.
Yeah, sure. So I think it's quite common to have people working in audiology departments not being culturally aware and to not have brilliant deaf awareness. Because I think sometimes if you know the medical model of deafness, you think that's maybe enough, but it doesn't actually translate into knowing how to communicate with deaf people. So we've certainly found in the different audiology departments and cochlear implant centre that we've been in, it seems to be it sort of across the board. There's, you know, maybe a couple of staff members who know sign language, but also, you know, more widely in the groups of families that we meet, we hear a lot of the same experience as ours. So like when I talk to you about our experience of him getting his surgery, that felt quite shocking maybe to you. But to other parents of children who are deaf, that's not really that shocking. That's very common.
That in itself is shocking, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's tricky. It's really hard. It's really hard because obviously these are professionals who are really good at whatever they're doing, and they know the medical model, and it's difficult when you're trying to advocate to the people who give you the information. So it's not that straightforward being the parent absolutely. In that situation. And because I think people panic about learning something new because you're thinking, oh, life is busy, and I get that. But if you're thinking I think as Teacher of the Deaf said to us, it's about connection over perfection. I think that's really helpful to keep in mind. It doesn't have to be like BSL is a full language. It's got its own grammar structure, everything. You're not expected to be perfect at that. But learning basic BSL is going to be so helpful in so many situations.
And so are there any sort of top words or phrases that you think anybody working in healthcare that would be working with somebody potentially like your son, what are the kind of key things that they could learn that would help them in that interaction with someone like your son?
I think a general deaf awareness would be super useful, but in terms of specific BSL, if you speak to my son about anything to do with cars, he's going to be hooked immediately. So learning basic signs for cars, there's some really almost intuitive signs that are easy to pick up, that are child friendly. So just whatever the, children are interested in, those kind of things. Basic BSL courses will give you introductions and the weather and these kind of things, but kids probably aren't that interested in talking about the weather. So maybe topics like TV programs or just like asking questions like, what do you like? How old are you? Kids like to talk about that kind of thing. So maybe that's a good starting point.
So if anybody's heard you speaking today, Kirsten, or read your piece and wants to now go and is feeling inspired and wants to go and learn a little bit of sign language, any hints, tips, where can they find the right information to do that?
A great place here in the UK to start would be the Signature website, and I'm sure there's similar wherever you are in the world. It's an accrediting body for sign language courses in the UK. So it's, I think it's just signature.co.uk. And they have like a map that you can find local courses that are accredited, taught by deaf tutors, which is really important. Or more informally, like social media is a great place to learn. Obviously, you have to be cautious with anything social media, but you know, there's different people teaching BSL. There's one specific one that she's a pediatric nurse, and she's deaf herself, a BSL user, and she shares healthcare related BSL videos, as well as more general deaf awareness. Her name is Asha. She's at Just Me Camille on Instagram. I'm not sure what she is on other platforms, so, but those are two great places to start.
And the last one you mentioned, we've linked that on your piece in the BMJ.
And that What Your Patient is Thinking article is now available online. We'll add some references and links to the show notes. And finally, the London Medical Orchestra has been playing for 70 years, and it's about to have a concert to celebrate that achievement. Some of the members have come into the studio to talk to the BMJ about the joy of playing music, despite a busy medical career.
I'm Stuart Delve. I'm the timpanist in the London Medical Orchestra, and I'm the longest serving member. I joined in 1990.
And I'm Peter Goff. I'm a retired GP, and I'm one of the trombonists in the London Medical Orchestra.
The story begins in 1900, which was the year of birth of a man called Hans Ucko, who was born to Jewish parents. He studied medicine at the Charité Hospital in Berlin and then took up a post there and was there doing research in the 1920s until 1933, when the new Nazi rules came in that said he had to be replaced by an Aryan, and he lost his job. He moved to Paris and re-established his research for a year. Then he moved to London, settled in the UK, re-established himself as a doctor. We don't know what he did musically in those years, but in 1953, he wrote a letter to the British Medical Journal and said, "I'd like to form a doctor's orchestra. Who would like to join me?" The letter was printed in September 1953. Within a month, he had his first rehearsal with 53 instrumentalists. And the first concert was in April 1954.
As a teenager, I was in the youth orchestra. I went all over Europe, mostly behind the Iron Curtain in places like East Berlin and East Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, playing some wonderful music, big symphonies, France, Switzerland. And that was all at school. But then as soon as I qualified, I was on a very heavy rota, being a junior doctor. There's no way of practicing a trombone in a doctor's mess. Then I became a GP, 14-hour days, on call again, one in two, one in three, nights and weekends, then a family. There's no way I could ever have continued playing during that time because it was such a busy job. The only time that I could do it was 40 years later. And I just started from scratch. I hadn't blown it for 40 years. And actually, you know, there's that feeling of regaining a sense of self. I think, you know, when you become a doctor, you put on this cloak. You're the doctor, and everybody sees you as the doctor. It's very difficult for them to see you as the person you really are. And just taking that cloak off and just connecting again with that sense of self. Music does that.
I think it's a long time since it had a very strong link with medicine. There are some doctors, there are some people who are working the NHS in other ways, and there are people who are absolutely nothing to do with it. So it became, you might call, a general orchestra a long time ago. It retained the title. The other link with medicine it retained is that all our concerts are for medical charities, or for charity, you know, in a loose way, a charity is connected to medicine in some form.
Certainly playing music and being, it's the ultimate team sport. You're playing together, you can't do without each other, you rely on each other. And trying to follow those little black notes on the music, as well as listening to the lovely music and being away from work, it immediately relaxes you. I could go at the beginning and be really stressed, and by an hour and a half later, I was much more relaxed. So it's a very good way of relaxing. So I think if there was a way of getting all those medics out there that have still got their instruments in the box, getting them out and giving them some opportunity to play, I think you'd have a much happier workforce.
In terms of now, what's coming up is our 70th anniversary concert. We're going to have a concert at the LSO St Luke's, which is that place not far from the Barbican. A fairly ambitious programme with as big an orchestra as we can find. You know, we're letting fly with these big pieces. It's on the 10th of March, which is a Sunday, at 6:30. As I said, it's at LSO St Luke's. So you can buy your tickets online or in person at the Barbican box office.
That's it for this episode. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Every article we've talked about is linked from the show notes. The references are there. And if you've got any comments on them or the podcast, we'd love to hear them. You can also share your thoughts with us in a rapid response on bmj.com. We'll be back in a fortnight with a clinician who has swapped the life of an intensive care doctor for the National Theatre. He's now the co-writer of the new Bevan play starring Michael Sheen. Also, coming up soon on the podcast, we'll be asking why the physician associate rollout is going so badly and how technology is changing the doctor-patient relationship. So don't miss out on those. Subscribe to our podcast. Until then, I'm Cameron Abassi. Thanks for listening.